Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. This is show 50. This week's guest is Jeff Corte. Jeff comes to talk to us about his Lake Superior projects, an 8x10 pinhole camera with 25 pinholes, and lots of other stuff. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. This is show 50. Andrew?
I want to say happy birthday, but it sounds like it should be. It sounds like it should be our birthday, but it's not.
It's close.
50.
Yep, almost there. I'm still completely people are listeners are being sent to their car, to their homes. People actually enjoy what we're doing because I enjoy doing it. So glad that we can bring some joy to folks. Andrew, how do you feel about it?
Do you think that's what do you think that's what we do? Bring joy.
I hope so.
That's good. That's a Japanese lady on Netflix who's taking the world by storm. I forget what her name is, but if you've got a really untidy house. And you should get rid of things, and only hold on to the things that bring you joy.
Yeah, I know that. We do that too. So, when we do our spring cleaning.
Yeah, if it brings you joy, then keep it. If it doesn't, then give it away.
Yeah. Our other rule is if you haven't touched it in 6 months, then.
Does that apply to cameras though?
Well, I kind of keep those in the. I don't have that many actually, so I kind of use the ones I have, but. I don't know. Anyways.
So have you had a good week?
Yeah, it's been a great week. Weather's kind of warmed up for us a little bit. It hasn't been so completely drunk weather, you know.
Yeah.
20 degrees one day and 60 degrees the next. We've been kind of at a steady, so that's nice. How's your week been?
Okay. Work is a bit troublesome, but that's... That's not really a story for the podcast, but that'll resolve itself in due course. But it's all right. Have I got any photography done this week? I'm just struggling to think. I developed some film this morning from the Titan Harman pinhole camera.
Right.
I went to see my cousins yesterday, and they're all musicians, but they play squeeze box and fiddle. You know, when we colonized America, a lot of the Celtic guys from Scotland and Ireland went over and they took their music with them and they went to the areas around the Appalachian Mountains and that sort of turned into what you might call bluegrass and that sort of thing. Well, you know, my cousins play that sort of music and we just went to their house yesterday because my cousin's not very well. And a guy came around called Mario and he brought his fiddle around. And before I knew it, they were playing like jigs and reels and Irishy type music, you know, fantastic. But I didn't have the only cameras I had with me were pinhole cameras and it was really dark in that. So it's a shame, really. So good. And I've been doing, I've been perfecting my salt printing. I can bore you with that, but. I'm finally got to a point where the X-ray negatives, I can make them contrasty enough to get a half decent salt print on on watercolor paper. I can tell you're really interested.
I'm super interested.
I get some abuse on the Facebook group for talking about salt prints. I think it's just jealousy.
It is.
Yeah.
Speaking of salt prints. So speaking of jealousy, Jeff, do you do salt prints?
Yeah, no, that's not something I picked up. I'm looking at the one on your page, Andrew, though, and I think I just don't know how that's done.
Well, I could explain it to you, but we might lose all the listeners.
Yeah. Okay.
Simultaneously, sound of tapping of phones. Okay, so this week's guest is Jeff. And Jeff, before the show, we didn't ask you the correct way to pronounce your name. So, your last name.
Oh, that's...
So, Andrew, you get to try it first. What do you think it is, Andrew?
Well, I've always just read it in my head as Corte, but who knows?
Corey?
Court.
It's Corte.
There you go.
Corte.
Yeah,
no, I was close.
You were both close.
Yeah.
Corte.
So this week's guest is Jeff Corte.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah.
It is. It's not to be confused with Jeff O'Connell.
Well, I hope not. I don't know. Oh, and by the way, you know,
he was a previous kid.
Congrats on the big 50. I think that's just terrific, you guys.
Yeah. Well, it's Corey. Corey's been at it for 50 weeks. I've been at it for 44, something like that. I don't know.
Amazing. Amazing.
So, Jeff is going to be an exciting guest, Andrew.
I think so. I'm always in awe of these people who have been making pinhole pictures far longer than I have.
Yeah, me too.
I'm back.
One day.
There he is. Jeff. Hey, Jeff.
Hi.
One day I feel like I'm going to be found out because actually, you know, I'm very enthusiastic and love using pinhole cameras, but I'm not the world's expert, you know, and I'm just really pleased that we've been able to keep going with all these awesome guests for the last year or so. And if we've just inspired people to get out there, you know, with their pinhole cameras or to make a pinhole camera, then our work is done.
Yeah.
Well, it isn't done. We should carry on, I think, if we can carry on finding guests as we close in on our 52nd show. It's exciting, isn't it?
So I want to know, Jeff, how do you find, courage or the strength to go out to Lake Superior and take pictures in freezing cold? Because it's like 12 degrees up there. What's it? What is it like up there? Right now?
Well, 12C, it's... it was 12 below this morning when I got out of bed. Yeah. And a high of zero thereabouts. And I don't know, you know, the first few weeks of winter are just brutal.
Right.
But eventually, once you endure enough of that, it feels like a heat spell when it hits 10 above. So it's all relative, really. Yeah.
I love this picture that you shot of Lake Superior with the rocks, and they were like covered in ice with the clouds.
Yeah. Yes. Beautiful place.
Looks like it could be Antarctica or somewhere. I don't know. I like those clouds.
That's really something that's so attractive with pinhole is because ordinary things just become extraordinary, you know,
right.
Just, you can focus in, you can plant your camera on something that, you know, is at your feet and make an exposure and it can just be otherworldly.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, if you want to follow along, as we often say, probably the easiest place to see the definitive sort of Lake Superior pictures, I would think, Jeff, is your website, Jeff Corte. Corte.com.
Yep, it's there. The images are also on my Instagram account, Jeff's back pages. So that's the collection. That website's kind of old, and you know how websites go. It's just not so easy to get around, and you know. So this new medium that I'm relatively new to. Instagram, and it's just kind of a nice flat way to look at a bunch of work.
Yeah,
it is. But I still like websites and Flickr, funnily enough, for the way it just allows you to group things in a fairly sensible way. I mean, you can look at Flickr and find a group of images, or you can look at people's websites and understand, you know, what set you're looking at. You know, you can look at Lake Superior pinholes, apertures, and which we'll come on to Isle Royal. No, I like websites. I like to be able to look at things, not just in Instagram. Your love affair with Lake Superior goes back a few years, I think, Jeff. Maybe you want to just take us back to how you first got involved in pinholing around Lake Superior.
Sure.
And pinholing in general, either way.
Yeah.
You know, it does go back a ways. And Yeah, I think you know, the first camera that I ever built was, of course, the old round tube camera, and made one of those back in the 80s.
Is that the mailing tube? I saw reference to the mailing tube.
Yeah, that's the mailing tube, and it's just sort of a more hardy version of the oatmeal box camera. It's, you know, we'll either take a sheet of paper 8x10 or negative, mm-hmm. and that was really my first experience with pinhole. And so from there, you know, it just grew. I just loved what I was seeing and the whole process of actually not seeing what you're going to be exposing and composing and just letting chance take over. And so I started building these other kind of experimental cameras, and those, you know, kind of freed me up. I was getting a little burned out shooting, you know, Tri-X 35 millimeter for years and years. You know, it was buying 100-foot rolls of that stuff and pre-rolling all the cassettes and going through that in a week or two. So I was just looking for something new before I hung up photography completely. And so pinhole really kind of saved the day for me, and it got me really excited about thinking of something that I wanted to photograph and then realizing that, you know, I could make a camera to make that happen, and there were really no limitations. So I started doing that 80s-ish, and got pretty excited about, well, what if I put a bunch of apertures on the face of a box camera, you know, and using 4x5 or 8x10 film and collecting exposures, you know, all on the same sheet of film. And it took off for me, and I've never gotten tired of it.
I was going to say, if you're getting results like what you're getting with this 25 lens 8x10 you have, that the pictures on your Instagram with the trees and the buildings,
mm-hmm.
man, those are great. Yeah, that definitely would keep me interested in it.
Yeah. You know, those are on 8x10 negs, and it's with a box that actually has 48 pinholes on it, but I just tape it off. I, you know, there are some test shots that I have up there of all 48, but boy, that's just,
I'm looking at that one. I think that's with the house.
That was our old house, our old backyard. Some of the tests that I was doing just to, you know, you make those pinholes one at a time and you hope that they're close to being
the same,
you know, otherwise you're dodging and burning.
Yeah.
So I, you kind of let it go to chance, but
how did you just take like a piece of 8x10 paper and put some tape around it and cover them all up and just take it off at one time and then put it back on? I mean, you just sit there, pull each 40 little tiny pieces of tape the size of your finger off, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, if it's they're going to be the same exposure simultaneously, then yeah, you know, that box that holds the 8x10 holds the 8x10 sheet film holders. So I can pull out that dark slide.
Oh yeah.
Sure. Put a big black card over the face of the camera and lift the card away, and then they're all exposed the same.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one with the cars is just awesome. With all the bumpers of the cars, all the different cars. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the street rod.
Yeah, the street rod.
Is it the same car, or no? It's not the same.
It's different.
No, you know, we have. I think it's every other year at our state, Minnesota State Fairgrounds. They just all collect, and there must be several hundred these shiny, fancy cars that pull up, and the people hang out, and of course they lift the hood. And I'm not a car guy really, but I spent probably a day walking around with that box camera and tripod, and resetting that camera 25 different times to collect those 25 exposures of a whole variety of cars.
You did a good job.
And it's quite a scene there. It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Cars in the sunlight are shiny, aren't they? So it's they make great subjects. This is on Jeff's Instagram page, listeners, and it's an image made with 25 aperture pinhole camera at the Street Rod Association meet, Minnesota State Fairgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So you're moving your camera around. So you've got 25 pinholes. Some are of the same camera. I mean, some are of the same car. For instance, along the bottom edge, that those four or five look the same car. But then you're physically moving the camera and then opening some different pinhole apertures, are you? Is that what you're doing?
Exactly. Yeah, just, you know, setting and deciding for that particular shot. You know, I wanted to have a car kind of around each edge, and so I would move and set for the three different exposures of the same car. Yep. And then the center pinholes are just picking out more cars. And hoping that I don't you know, expose the same pinhole twice and forget the other one. And so it's pretty disappointing when you go through that and you realize after you pull it out of the tank that you've missed one or something's gone haywire.
Yeah.
What inspired you to go down this route of the multi pinhole approach?
You know, I think, I've thought about that, but it goes back to when I actually, what am I going to do with my photography? And it, you know, just wanting to try something different. But seriously, there's a club in Minneapolis called First Avenue. And it was a place where Prince used to play a lot, but this was kind of before Prince's time. And I was down there looking at the, I was having a pint, and I noticed all of this this glass block that they have. It's a wall of glass block, and the stage lighting and things were coming through all of these different glass blocks, and it was creating, you know, a dozen or more apertures. And I looked at that and I thought, holy smokes, you know, look at the patterns, look at the distinct little vignettes that I'm seeing from the bar. You know, what if, you know, I could translate that to a box camera. And that's awesome. seriously how that started.
Cool.
But can I drag you back to some Lake Superior images, Jeff? Is that all right?
Because
I'm struck by the story of Lake Superior. I know you were an artist. You got some kind of artist in residence, did you, or some fellowship to go? And did that take you to go and study, to go and spend some time there? Or tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. The artist in residence program on Isle Royal. Isle Royal is in the National Park System, and it's a remote island in Lake Superior. It probably has the fewest visitors because you have to take a ferry to get there or a float plane.
Yep. Yeah, just near Thunder Bay.
Yeah, just off, and it's you know, it can be an hour and a half boat ride to get there. It's pretty primitive, but they kicked off a artist in residence program. I want to say 92, I think, and you know, I was very fortunate to get picked that first year to go out to the island of all places and have as much time as I wanted and bring boxes of unexposed sheet film and my pinhole cameras. And wow. So, boy, what a treat. And so I was out there. They had a guest cabin that they put the artists in for their stay. And I was there for about 3 weeks, just walking, canoeing, exposing film, and you know, getting back to the cabin in the evening and downloading it, boxing up the unexposed sheets, and loading up more stuff for the next day. So, a really wonderful remote.
Sure.
Place. It doesn't appear to be any roads on this island.
What year was that? Was that recently, or was that?
Yeah, I think that was 1992. It was the first year of the program. Yeah, no roads.
You were just a baby. You were just a baby, Corey.
I was 21. But come on.
Actually, this island has got lakes within it, hasn't it?
So, it does. It's
amazing.
Yeah, people will you know, take their kayak out there. They'll either put it onto the boat and. Or they'll actually make the trek in a kayak across from Thunder Bay. People will go out there. It's terrific fishing in those inland waters and around the island itself, trout and lake trout especially. And it's got a lot of history. There were copper mines from the indigenous from, a few hundred years ago out there. They'd go out and mine the copper. So you can find these divots in the rock where they have, they've taken the copper out. And so there's a really long history of different peoples on that island.
And so you have in your website, you have a section called Isle Royal, and that they're presumably were they all taken during this time
when you every were one of them? Yeah.
What's the
there's one of you rowing out there. See, I've done that as well. Your picture is better than mine, but I've tried that as well. But yours come out a lot better.
actually, he was. That is one of the first people that I met when I landed on the island, and he was a life residency. His family went back generations on that island, and so he happened to be out there for the summer on one of the cabins that they still allow people to live in. And his name is John, and he had this beautiful restored wooden boat that they kept up there in a boathouse, and he took me out in that one evening, and that's, you see that picture of him rowing, and it's a gorgeous boat, and I was shooting really slow Polaroid Type 55, and it was a pretty magical evening.
Cool. Are these all? I hadn't noticed. Not all of them, but some of them are Polaroids, aren't they? So this is 55 Posneg stuff. But were you shooting that? What camera were you shooting these in, Jeff?
These were all in the. It's a 4x5 single pinhole camera.
Okay.
Yeah, and it'll take. It's kind of a box with the rubber bands and black tape, and it does accept film holders, so I can load up sheets, and it'll take, of course, that Polaroid film back too. So
yeah,
I
the Polaroid in. Back with the I've got one of those, but only because I was shooting a new 55 film, but not much of it because it was so very expensive. But that's the one with a little lever you move over, and then you pull it over, and then pull it through the rollers.
That's the deal. And I love that film.
Ansel Adams was a great. I've got a book by Ansel Adams of Polaroids, and I think they're mainly Type 55. Beautiful, beautiful film.
Oh, the film is just almost grainless, and the tonality is just.
Have you got any left, or have you?
No. I wish, and I really miss it because I would shoot it for the neg alone, and just take care to process the negatives from that, and pulling the Polaroid pack apart and seeing what you got, and it's got that kind of goopy gel in there, and so that you can still experiment with that and embed things into that and seal it back up.
I found my Polaroid 103 camera in the cupboard the other day, and I noticed it still had film in there, and I couldn't remember for the life of me what it was, so I went out and I thought, well, it's definitely 100 speed film or thereabouts. So I'm going to set the
color black and white.
Yeah, but I'm going to set the dial to lighten because it's not. I knew it wasn't FP100C. It was a Polaroid, expired Polaroid. And I shot it. And it turned out to be the last two frames of Polaroid blue film, which I had, which I really love. Oh. And it's that smell. You know that smell when you pull it apart? And I sat in the car and I stuck that goop to my nose
and wept,
and I just inhaled and a tear formed in the corner of my eye. But a friend of mine is Meredith Wilson. She's shooting with some of the very latest batches of new 55 because I think they've put together some, it's not the original people, but maybe an offshoot, Sam Heiser, I think, is put together some new batches of new 55, and it's very limited, and it's still maybe $65, $75 a pack. But it's
isn't that the single ones? Is that the single
ones? No. This is new 4x5 film, Corey.
Yeah.
It's started off as the new 55 project, which was a Kickstarter, and they hit some trouble with not being able to get the little clips. I think they were on the pods manufactured, but there's one of the guys who worked with New 55 has taken the remaining stock. I think he might be still coating some. I'm not sure, but it's very low volume production. But there is a viable at the moment. You can still go and buy new 55, but it's not cheap. But Meredith has posted some lovely results with it.
Cool.
But you can only spend your money once, can't you? You know, you can't. You've got to choose what you spend your money on.
Yeah. You know, and sure. There are still other beautiful films that are...
Unless you have lots of money.
That are
made. That's true. Yeah. Jeff, whatever pinhole camera you're using for your Lake Superior shots, I mean, Corey was talking about that. There's an image you've got of rocks covered in ice, like stalactites almost. Mm-hmm. And then you...
It looks like a scoop of vanilla ice cream.
And then you've got detail in the sky, you know, the highlights aren't blown out and you've got some detail in the shadows, and it's bitingly sharp, isn't it? I mean, people would look at this and think, well, it's hard to think it's a pinhole shot.
Well, I think, well, they're, well, you know, they're not sharp, but...
Well, they're pretty good.
The degree of sharpness, I think, is the same course from right in front of the pinhole to the horizon.
That's the thing, isn't it?
You know, I think, and I when I had some of these, just going back to the multiple pinholes for a second, that was a comment that I heard a lot, because they appear sharp, and the reason those appear sharp is because, you know, you're exposing on a large sheet of film, you're ganging up 9 or more exposures to create one large exposure, and each exposure is, you know, the focal distance on each of those is probably a half inch.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, you know, combining all of that together suggests that they're sharper than actually if you were to take one of those vignettes and look at it. So if you get what I'm saying, it's, you know,
I do, and I realize I realize they're not lens photographs, so they're not, you know, if you study them that closely, you'll see that they're pinhole images, but that's of course the charm. But then there are, you know, there's degrees of, do you know what I mean, degrees of sort of results you get with pinhole, and from the very ethereal almost to the, you know, to these which are so sharp, you know, do you know what I mean?
The other thing you got to think about, though, is that once you get your camera on a tripod and you can get a good system of opening and closing your apertures without any movement,
that helps.
It a lot. Once you can figure out a system for getting no movement
camera. But I think with the dark slides, the best one is just to if you've got a lens cap, take the lens cap off, stick your finger over the hole, and then take the dark slide out.
Oh yeah, sure,
exactly. Mm. Yeah, that's what I do.
Are you making?
You have 25 fingers. Yeah. Using your toes, Jeff?
I got something to show you here.
You should. People have lots of fingers and toes in the fens because they all interbreed with each other.
Oh.
It's okay. Nobody listens to this show from around here, so it's fine.
Yeah, right. Okay, good.
Are you making prints yourself of these, Jeff, or these scans, or
these were made, you know, back when I still did a lot of darkroom work, and so there are silver prints that exist of almost all of these Lake Superior shots. I had the good luck to have worked in a black and white lab many years ago. So, you know, my daily was to process other people's black and white film. And we had access to dark room. We had access to 8x10 enlargers. Mm. And so, I mean, I lived in there and cranked out stacks of Ilford fiber-based prints. That was my go-to paper. And, you know, I have since...
Were you using graded?
Yes, multi-grade. Yep. Gotcha. Yeah, I love that paper. And, you know, since then, I have scanned all of these. I use a wet mount process and the oil and all of that and sandwich that in. And
for your 8x10s?
For the 8x10s.
I've seen reference to wet scanning, but... I'm I'm a scanning. I hate scanning, really. But
I do too.
But I've heard references to it. Do you want to just? I think it'd be really interesting. I think listeners would maybe be interested to hear about that process.
Sure.
Some people would know about it, and some wouldn't. But maybe could you just maybe just tell us a little bit about wet scanning?
Yeah. I got myself a flatbed. I couldn't afford to take these out and have somebody drum scan the negatives. So using a flatbed scanner, I had discovered that the same oil that drum scanners use to mount film to the drum scan, I could use on a flatbed. And, by sandwiching that piece of film in between a layer of, it goes acetate, oil, film, oil, glass. So you've got that wonderful, completely flat sandwich and a negative that is kind of living in that oil, those oil layers, and that becomes your scanning medium.
What sort of oil is it, Jeff?
Well, it's drum scanner. It's drum scanner oil. Okay. So it's made for, the commercial labs.
Right.
And I ordered up a big, I think
and,
it was a
and
quart.
Do you coat this onto your negative or the sandwich medium that you're using? How do you do it?
It comes out of the bottle in kind of a squirt nozzle top. Yeah.
Right.
And you just put enough down there so you can get rid of the air bells and lay the acetate over that sandwich, and it just
smooths
out. And what you end up with is, it helps apparent contrast, the oil, all of the benefits of oil, like a drum scanner,
mm-hmm.
you get with that oil, and just the fact that you've adhered that piece of film to a sheet of glass means that you've got edge to edge sharpness. There's no negative curl, which I just really wanted to avoid, especially with a bigger piece of film. And for me, it worked out just really, really, really great.
See, I use glass negative carriers in my De Vere 4x5 enlarger. But I have anti-Newton glass on the top.
Perfect.
And that holds it nice and flat. And I don't really get much trouble with dust or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But this process with the oil, presumably because you're using the oil, the anti-Newton rings somehow are eliminated.
Yeah, you don't need it. Yeah, because you're not glass to film.
Yes.
That oil takes care of any kind of Newton ring effect.
Interesting.
So when you finish, do you have to rewash your negatives again? Just soak them in warm water?
You can hang them, and they that oil just vanishes.
Does it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Is it
a solvent based? It must be solvent based then, with a fairly high flash point.
Yeah. Well, they say don't smoke.
Yeah. There you go.
Don't smoke and scan. But,
don't smoke at all, actually. Yes.
No, listeners, don't smoke. It's bad for you.
No, I would never.
Just go in the dark room and sniff developer and fixer. You'll be fine.
So I've got all these things, digitized now. And so.
Don't you feel the urge to go back into the dark room?
Yes.
Because if you sort of hang out on social media, some of the websites that we go into, and that sounds really dodgy, doesn't it? So
shaky.
Yeah,
places.
like the negative, the guys on the negative positives Facebook group. There's so many people apparently getting back into darkroom work.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful process and. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to spend a day cleaning out my darkroom in the basement just so I could.
Have it. You just need to bring it back to life. Well, there you go.
Exactly.
You should do that.
Still have my Bessler set up down there. It's a 4x5, and
there you go.
Trays and everything.
You can send it to me if you don't want it.
Sure.
I'll drive out and get it. Actually.
Yeah. No. It's it could be revived.
I'd like to have one, but I really enjoy just doing contact printing right now. I don't know what it is about it. I started printing my 6x6 negatives, and I enjoy doing that. But I enjoy just doing contact prints more. Contact, I don't know what it is about it.
I'm enjoying making contact prints as well, or yeah. prints that aren't much bigger than 4x5, you know? And there's something incredibly beautiful in that small print, just holding it in your hand.
I don't know. I always enjoyed the process of making test strips and dodging and burning and like blowing up a regular negative. But even if I got a 4x5 and larger, I probably would still just do contact prints. You know, I don't know what it is.
It's also useful for making prints from a 6x12, you know, pinhole camera or something, because that 6x12 would fits straight into 4x5. I have a 6.17 back on my large format camera, and that doesn't fit in it. At the moment, all I can do really is either scan or do a contact print.
So,
go on, Corey. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, were you printing, enlarging your 8x10s, Jeff, or were you contact printing?
I was enlarging those. I mean, that was just for that time that I had access to that big enlarger that could. You put an 8x10 neg in there, it still blows me away.
Was it on the side? It was on the side. Was it on the wall, like a countertop?
Yeah, it was a wall mount, and you would put that neg in just like you would on a 4x5 enlarger, except everything's bigger. And I only went up to say 20-24 with those, but boy, what a time that was!
I bet. Andrew, you should make one.
No, I've seen one. So I may have told this story before. I don't know, but who knows? Who cares? But if a story is good, it's worth telling twice. So I bought my 4x5 enlarger from a lovely gentleman in the UK called Steve Segsby. And many of you will follow Steve on Twitter. He's a large format photographer. He's one of four or five guys in a little film collective called Inside the Outside. And he's does a lot of platinum palladium printing and things like that. And he sold me his 4x5 De Vere enlarger. And then because he just bought himself a De Vere 8x10 with a Ilford multigrade head on it. And this thing is kind of motorized, you know, he can control it all. It's like a space age device. I mean, it's huge. I mean, really. Really big. Before. And I have seen a bigger enlarger. There's a laboratory in Birmingham called AG Photographic. And Matt there, he bought an enlarger, and I can't remember. I think it might be 20x24. And it's like twice as big as an 8x10. And he had it. He didn't know what to do with it. He had it sat in the middle of his store and surrounded by all his products. And this is a beast. I don't know if he's still got it. I'm sure it either takes 16x20 negs or 16x24. Wow. It's certainly maybe double 8x10, and it's huge. Mm-hmm. And if you've never seen, I mean, this is, you know, it would just fill my darkroom and more.
Wow.
That's so big. But contact prints, yeah. It's what I'm doing with my X-ray negatives at the moment, because I don't know what else to do
with them. Have you tried any of the X-ray film, Jeff, or any of the new?
You know, that's news to me. I have not. No, my go-tos have always been the Ilford films, the FP4, and if you can't shoot the Polaroid, FP4 is another great tonal, fine-grained film, and so I've kind of stuck with what you can get at the camera shop.
FP4 is your go-to film in all formats, Jeff? Are you shooting medium format film as well as sheet film?
Not so much paper. Medium. No, it's all either 4x, it's all sheet film essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I pick up my 35 stuff, I'm still a big fan of Tri-X at ASA 200. You know, and
yeah,
then you account for that in the dark room and you pull up your shadows, and so Tri-X allows you to shoot relatively fast but still open everything up, so that's a nice film.
Yeah, HP5 would be my go-to, really. Mm-hmm. HP5 in medium format. Large format, FP4 is probably my go-to. I shoot quite a bit of FOMA pan because that's relatively cheap. cheap. Yes, cheap. And then this, in my 8x10 pinhole camera, I just started using the X-ray film because that's cheap as well, you know?
And you get a lot of it.
Yeah. 100 what are you developing your FP4 in, Jeff? What's your go-to? Do you have a standard process?
Yeah, I've been using ID11 for years, and I just...
Me too.
Go one-to-one.
Me too.
And, yep. And
8.5 minutes. 8 minutes.
I'm probably up around 11-ish, 10.
Are you? That's interesting.
10 to 11, just, you know, it all depends on how you compensate when you expose. So that's 8 to 10 or 11 is in the realm.
That's Ilford's, right?
Yeah, ID 11. And
I think I'm going to get that next when I finish off this.
It's like, it's a sort it's a D76 equivalent. So it's a bit more. It's a bit more messing around, Corey. So I buy it in the 5 liter powder packs, and I make it up in a bucket in the house, and then
I do. Well, now that I have the Ilfosol 3, I have it, man. I can just do that one shot as I need it.
But I don't think there's any magic bullet, Corey. You know, you need to find something that you get nice with. You can be forever jumping down rabbit holes looking for paper film.
For a really long time, my developer. I liked Xtol. I used that I've used that forever. I don't know. And I just wanted to try all the
Ilfosol stuff. Developers. I mean, it's a whole topic in itself. If you tune into anything that Tim Layton does, or subscribe to his online magazine called Darkroom Underground, which I did for a year or so, he publishes some great articles on how developers work, and we don't think about them because there are some that are called, you know, sort of solvent developers like ID11, and there's the different types that work in different ways depending on how you dilute the developer. They can change the nature of how they behave, but to be honest, you find one that works for you and that you like, and therefore you're starting to take all the stress out of your life, aren't you? You know, because I do use different developers, but ID11, 1+1, and FP4, and I use it for HP5.
It's a pretty good combination.
I don't do much pushing and pulling. I'm shooting at really, really, you know, slow ISO, ASAs, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
but I mean, I'm exposing typically FP4 at probably 80 or 100.
Yeah.
And HP5 HP5 at 250 or 320.
Yeah. Yeah. We're in that same range. You know, I played around with developers for a while and tried Rodinal. Have you guys ever?
Yeah, I have some of that. Yeah, because I use that for the X-ray.
Oh, film. You do.
Okay. Yeah, because somebody told me that it works, and it really does. Yeah. But that's all I'm using it for.
I was never able to control it, and because of the measuring of the liquid, one or two experiences I had with that was I just got huge grain. You know, which actually I was happy that I did, because it was an accident that, I thought this is really, so it's not always about eliminating grain or anything, but in that case, using Rodinal, forget the film I was using. It was just a look that I stumbled onto and really liked.
Cool. Yeah.
No, but I'm with you. I've hopped around with pyro developers and, which is a great favorite of large format photographers and alternative processes. But to be honest, I stick with ID11, you know? Oh. And I think mainly because I started with it as well all those years ago. FP4, FP4 and ID11 were my 35mm go-to combination.
It is perfect. And you want to pick something that you know is going to be around, so that you can dial it in. And like you said, you don't have to... think too hard about, you know, getting into a new film or developer.
No. I play around with the developing time sometimes. If I'm out in the fens and the lighting is a bit low contrast, then I maybe just increase that development time, probably closer to what you're shooting at, Jeff. Or if it's really bright, then I may contract it a little bit. But I think at 8 minutes or 8.5 minutes, I'm probably at the bottom end, really. And I find that I get highlights that I can control pretty well in the darkroom.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And like you mentioned earlier, it gets to be that high noon time of day, and if it's you know, if there's nothing but just this bald sun up in the sky, I just kind of pack my camera away and wait for the afternoon light to return.
Me too. What, I have to do that a lot here, actually.
Mm-hmm.
What projects are you working on at the moment? Is this, is Lake Superior one of those projects that will never end, or you, what are you up to at the moment?
You know, I think Lake Superior is never going to end. It's because it's a place that I would go to even if I weren't photographing. Mm-hmm. It's just a destination for me and has been. You know, there, I have a lot of years of travel up there and a lot of memories with, you know, I would shoot a lot with my brother and my dad. We would, we'd hop in the car and just take a long weekend up there and stay at a little cabin and do nothing but hike the shoreline. So, you know, I think that's always going to be happening for me.
Which part, I mean, Lake Superior is huge. I couldn't mm-hmm. work out. I mean, it must be several hundred miles across, depending on how you measure it.
Yep. If you're going east or west to east, you're right. Mm. And, you know, Minnesota has the North Shore. So that is really the stretch of the lake all the way up to the Canadian border. You know, that
up towards Thunder Bay.
Up toward Thunder Bay. And, you know, from there, that's the the launching point to Isle Royale, of course. And
yep.
Mm-hmm. So you can really get lost, and it's all on our side of the lake, that east, that west side. It's rocky. It's, you know, basalt and ancient.
Do they have Canadian Mounties waiting for you at the border to send you back? Like, you know,
no, but they will. They will inspect your car, and they will. Oh yeah, yeah. Yep. So and I don't go into Canada very often. There's just enough to do here in Minnesota.
Doesn't Donald Trump want to build a wall along there to keep keep the Canadians out?
Yeah, well, that's another story. No, but I don't, you know, the projects really, you know, if it's not up there, if it's not up north, it's the rivers, it's the lakes down here. I've kind of put down for now the multiple pinhole. Just because I've found that I really have to find a lot of time to be able to do that stuff with the multiples. Whereas, you know, like you guys do, you take the your pinhole camera, it can become your everyday camera. And and so my little 4x5 single pinhole box is something that I can just have with me daily because I like to shoot just as much as possible. It's not always pinhole. I do a lot of other stuff that is not pinhole, but
yeah, I saw that you do a lot of on your other Instagram page, some landscapes and but that are like most of that's done with digital, right?
That's digital, right? Yeah. Yep, and
those,
that you know,
those are great pictures.
It's that, or you know, it's not being able to shoot as much as you'd like to. So sure. You know,
you can do.
I really struggled for a while with the you know. Coming up with film and handmade boxes and darkroom time. And then suddenly, wham, this, you know, the first digital cameras appeared. And there was all of this conversation about, well, you know, you digital isn't really art. And, you know, you're scanning stuff. Or if you're going to shoot film, you can only print it in the darkroom. And right. So, boy, that was kind of an interesting few years until people got it sorted out that, you know, it's at least in my mind, it's not, you know, it's the end result and it's the process sure. and the steps you take to get there. And so I've totally reconciled the kind of weird marriage of analog, meaning film and pinhole and ending up with something that might get scanned on a flatbed and sent through an Epson printer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we're all, most of us are following some kind, most analog photographers are following some kind of hybrid system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I've kind of decided this is going to be the year of printmaking. I'm avoiding scanning negatives, but I'm still scanning negatives or, scanning prints or photographing them for sharing on social media. So we rely on this digital medium to support our analog love, don't we?
Sure.
Which is ironic. The only thing I've never really, as you guys know, if you've listened to me banging on about it, I've never picked up a digital camera really in earnest. I had one for work once, but the whole digital thing kind of passed me by, really. I saw no reason to ever give up my film cameras, and I've always had a dark room, so that's been fine. The one thing I wouldn't like about I'm blown away by many, many images I see made with digital technology. Some of them, when it verges into, I don't know what it is that kind of hyper reality. Some of them just kind of want to just cut my eyebrows. They appear, my eyebrows, my eyeballs.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is. Is it whatever bad the digital process?
Bad HDR.
Oh, is it?
Can you get a cream for that? Can you get a cream for that? Get yourself down the doctors and get some cream for that bad HDR, whatever that is.
Yeah, that can be so abused.
Is that problem, what that is? That I don't know what it is, but I see it, I thought, well, if that's digital photography, you can keep it.
Oh boy, I there is some beautiful, beautiful digital photography out there, but it's done by people who know how to control it and don't use it and overdo it with the digitalness of the technology. And HDR is really a case where I'm with you. They're kind of hard to look at.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I like this picture on your other feed that you have, Jeff, your main page on Instagram, the ghosts of July 4th past with a dot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a great picture.
That's my family, and you know, that one goes back. That's probably when our family was all together. That's probably a mid '90s pinhole.
Yeah,
and my son, who's you know, holding himself up there on the little swim ladder. He's a junior now in college. So it's fun to look back at that. For my mom and dad are in there. And it's, again, it's another lake, one of 10,000 in Minnesota.
Yeah. You seem to not have a really wide focal length on your pinholes. You seem to use a little bit more of a standard kind of tighter focal length.
Well, I can
as opposed to me, like I like really, really wide, like ultra mega wide, you know, like super crazy distorted, you know, pinhole shape is really what I like. But
I think the box that I'm, the 4x5 that I'm using, I'm looking at it now here. I think, you know, it's probably 2.5, almost 3-inch focal distance.
Right.
So I'm getting a closer. It's still wide, but it's not super wide. It's enough to cover the sheet of film without a terrible vignetting.
It'll be if it's that kind of 3 inches, though, that's going to be similar to the Walker Titan Corey, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that one I have is a 72mm. So that's, I don't know, it's probably 2.5 inches.
Jeff, you go back into your feed. There's some crazy distorted buildings, Corey. If you want distorted, made with tubular cameras or whatever, you know.
Yeah, sure. No, I just meant like that picture of the dock is definitely almost like a regular focal length. You know, it seems like it's not you know, a mega wide picture.
No, I think.
Nor are some of these like the shoreline of Lake Superior. You know, they're not. You're close to them, I'm sure. But they're not. You don't have any major, you know, that pinhole, quote unquote pinhole look. You know what I mean? Where it's not.
Do you know what I love?
I like this focal length. I mean, I'm glad I got that. I'm glad I have that camera for Mike now, because I think I'm going to see if he'll let me trade that wide angle cone for the next step up.
Well, then you'll have a camera that is, you know, you've got lots of cameras to do wide stuff, and then suddenly you've got one that is just a bit tighter.
Yeah.
Before Corey spoke over me then. He's so rude, isn't he? Did you notice that? The series of images that I really love, be quiet, Corey, is Vapor Pinhole. And what on earth inspired you to look up at the clouds and pinhole the sky?
Oh, gosh.
And are you still doing those?
I haven't added to that vapor collection for a long time, but you know, again, when you're on a lake and you know, you're looking, where else do you look if you're not looking at the lake, and you have this big expanse of sky.
Yeah.
And you know, summer thunderstorms and the clouds that happen and change even over a couple hours in an afternoon. You know, I've always looked up there and have it's just been a sense of wonder at what's happening above you. And, you know, of course, with Pinhole, you're never going to freeze them in their tracks, which is really not desired anyway. But just loved to capture the different formations. And I've always been kind of a cloud geek anyway. So
cool.
Yeah, they're great. I think there's something about photography. There's great areas to be explored, and this is not an original area, but exploring the elements, you know, whether it's wind, whether it's light, whether it's water, you know, ground, you know, sound even, you know. But exploring those areas using not just pinhole photography, but John Blakemore, I've mentioned him before. I'm a great admirer of John's work, and John did a series of elemental studies of the elements probably in the 90s. And he photographed using very simple gear and very simple system. So he used ID-11, he used FP4, and he used his MPP Mark 7 or 8 with a standard lens. And he used nothing else, but he just his equipment then became second nature to him, you know, so it was comfortable for him to work with. There were no surprises, and it had allowed him to just focus on the elements. And he did a series of multiple exposures of water. So not just leaving the aperture open, but click, 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 click. So you got this series of individual sharp exposures, but together they formed a passage of time. And I've always been kind of drawn to that, but I think others have done it far better than I could ever do.
I agree.
I have to look that up. That's cool.
John Blakemore.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, he's a lovely gentleman. He's still going. He's in his late 80s now, but he's using digital cameras because his eyesight is very poor. He's also known for his studies of tulips. He went through a tulip phase in the 80s, and he started just photographing, noticing the way light fell on the tulips in a jar on his kitchen table. And he developed the project over several years to an amazing degree of tableaus of flowers, but also studies of tulips as they were going through stages of dying. And he made collages out of these tulips. And I've seen some of his original prints, and it's just beautiful, beautiful work. And he's very much into metaphors, photography as a metaphor, you know. So people like Minor White, who was a great proponent of you know, not just making a pretty picture, but expressing your sort of feelings through photography. So he's a great character, and there's some great writing out there by people like John. And I thought of all that when I just saw your clouds pictures, your vapor pinhole. There we go.
Yeah. So what holds the future, John? I mean, John.
John. ignore Corey. He always gets the names wrong.
What's the future for you as far as pinhole?
Well, you know, it's kind of been a slow period for me, actually, just shooting pinhole. Just, you know, time and other things that are going on, but
you've been posting a lot recently, haven't you? Is that because you knew you were coming to talk to us?
I wanted to get this stuff out there in a different way, and and just, you know, what it did was force me to go through negatives and boxes of old prints and collect all of the cameras that I've made and just kind of look at it with fresh eyes again. So, you know, I don't have.
To be determined.
Yeah, it really is at this point. But, you know, I think there's still, I think in one of the earlier episodes, you were talking about just going back and looking at old negs and printing old stuff.
Yeah.
And that's a project in itself. And
it is because the temptation, totally. You know, I see it on Twitter all the time. What are you shooting this weekend? As though you're going out there with a rifle to see how many birds you can shoot in an afternoon. I mean, flap, you know, with feathers. But and it's very tempting because we all like to go out there and be using the cameras and be creating new stuff. But actually, you know, if you go, I look at the amount of negatives I've got, and probably 5% have ever made it to print. You know, if that.
Yeah. So it sometimes, you know, you're all excited when you get back and look at that day's shoot or the weekend, and you come back and look at the same things a month or a year down the road, and there's a whole new meaning there.
Yes.
That's what I'm enjoying about, for anyone who's shooting medium format, you know, like 120 film or 35 millimeter or whatnot, and don't know if they want to go to the larger formats, I'm enjoying it more because I'm not developing as much, so I kind of have the ability to just let images that I've taken kind of just marinate, you know, and sit around because I'm only
because there are fewer of them.
Yeah, and I'm like my tank, I'm only processing 4 sheets at a time in my SP 445, you know. So I'll shoot one here, I'll shoot one there. I kind of gotten a little bit more selective about what I'm taking pictures of, and you know, so I don't see those images immediately as fast as I would if I was developing 120. Like, you shoot a roll of 120, you come over and develop it and scan it in an hour, you know what I mean? Right. So you don't have time to have that separation from them. So you kind of forget about what's in your 4x5 holders until you develop it and then gotten past the whole taking three or four images of one scene, which one do I like better? And then you still have to deal with those afterwards and putting them in negative holders and which one do you want to scan? And you scan all four of them to look at them on your computer screen, and then you still have them sitting there once you pick the one that you like, and you know, so it's just kind of.
Well, and it isn't long before you're out shooting again, and then that you know, layers and layers of
that cycle just keeps going. You know, so
yeah,
I don't know. My suggestion is to try 4x5 or something bigger if you're feeling that slump, because it's helped me out some. I haven't been shooting as much, but I feel like what I have been shooting is a little bit more along the lines of what I wanted to be shooting. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I keep my field camera in the back of the car with me most of the time. And I drive out over the fens in the morning as I'm going to my early morning swimming. And the light is just beautiful. And it's funny, I can set that field camera up on a tripod and I'm sure other cars think it's a speed camera, you know, then I'm setting it. So I think I might put a yellow vest on.
There you go. Are you storing that speed graphic in your budgie smugglers in the back?
No, I don't have a speed graphic. I have a Japanese Toyo camera.
Toyo.
Yeah.
You know, one of the very first shots that I took with that mailing tube camera, I took a photo of the old fire station in the town where I grew up. And, you know, with that tube camera, it holds 8x10. So it's kind of large. And you know, I approached the fire station and the guys were out there just shining up their fire truck. And you set this thing down because it won't go on a tripod. So I set this tube on the curb.
Backed away slowly.
And I backed away. and they're kind of holding their legs. And then I start looking at my watch.
if you ran away, then they would have really messed themselves, wouldn't they?
So, you know, 20, 30 seconds later, I put the tape over the box of the pinhole and picked it up. And I think you could almost see the relief on their faces.
I love the way the ladder, you know, on the back of the fire truck curves up like a banana. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tube cameras are a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. And you can see all of Jeff's work at Jeff's Back Pages. That's the best Instagram if you want to see
Pinhole.
Pinhole, JEFFSBACKPAGES.
Yeah.
They're great.
Yep.
Corey, anything else? Right.
No, I think that's it. Almost a year.
50.
Yep.
Congratulations again.
Yeah. This show will soon be as old as me in 3 weeks' time. Ah. How about that?
There you go. And I think Mark's going to be coming back to join us on the year on 52. On
It'll be like, you know those shows when all the previous Doctor Who's all appear at once? Do you know?
I haven't seen it. No, I don't know.
There's been, if you're a Doctor Who fan, there's been several shows over the years where all the Doctors have appeared together. And it'll be like that, the three of us.
Yeah. It'd be good to have Mark back on because he was sitting out in his car in Charlotte when we started doing the podcast. Because he has little kids too, you know.
He's very prolific with his Pinhole work. So
yeah,
definitely. I'll be excited to sort of chat with him and
if anybody has any questions for Mark start thinking about him because the first show of March no the second or third show of March I guess no
no this is the first show of March
yeah yeah not then... this week but next week next week next week
is it next week's
two shows. He'll be on the second show away from us now, yeah. Sorry, Jeff.
next week is Kai Lewis, who's a fantastic artist, artist living in London. And then I think we're at our birthday weekend, aren't we?
Yeah.
And are we going to have a we've been talking, Corey, haven't we, about running a competition, but maybe talk about that and speak about something next week or the week after.
Yeah, we'll figure something out. Okay. All right. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for coming.
Hey, it's been great. Been
hanging out with us.
Yeah, it's been a nice chat. Appreciate that. So I'm looking forward to number 52, too. And great show.
I know, right?
All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah. Andrew, so you want to... I guess not. We've already did it, didn't we?
People know where to find us, don't they, really? You know, we could spend the next 5 minutes telling people where to find us, but they know, really, if they're that interested.
Yeah. And please make sure you go and have a look at Jeff's Instagram pages.
Mm.
Take a look at his webpage and give him some feedback. Just talk to him. Everybody likes to talk about their work and pinhole photography in general, you know?
Yep.
I think so, Jeff. Do you like to have to talk about your work?
Oh, of course. You know, and quickly, I was just going to add that, you know, back when I got into Pinhole, there wasn't a social media. There was the Pinhole Resource, which was a Pinhole journal that came out quarterly. Yep. You found boxes and cameras and things in the advertisements in the back of the journal, and it was all print. And so, I mean, what a wonderful time we're in now with 50 plus pinhole photographers on a podcast. And it's just amazing what you see out there. So times are changing.
Yep. Yep.
Well, that's a great way to end the show on a Bob Dylan quote.
Yes.
Time to change. Yep. All right. So thanks for hanging out this week, everybody. And we're looking forward to talking to somebody next week and having you guys back again.
Yep.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
It's pretty iffy to plan anything.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think Andrew's here. Andrew, are you here?
Oh, sorry. Were you talking to me? I fell asleep then.
He naps a lot.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Jeff. I thought I was listening to the Weather Channel for a moment.
Yeah. I love weather. I don't know what it is about it. I like talking.
I know. It's every time you call me in and you're speaking to a guest, it's always about the weather.
Well, you know, I think it's something that the photographers are naturally tuned into just because it